Hello, and welcome back to the Death and Grief Talk podcast. I'm your host, Joelle Maldonado, and I'm also known as the Grave Woman. The words to have and to hold are commonly thought of as being a part of wedding or commitment vows. But for me, these words resonate across the board in all things, especially finance. When we really think about it, we are constantly in the process of working towards accumulating something. Possessions, money, a partner, a home, a vehicle, healthy relationships, our health, achieving our personal goals, and etc. During this accumulation of gathering to quote-unquote have, how many of us stop and think of the cost of holding on to what we have accumulated, especially when thinking about our personal finances and legacies? In today's world, we are constantly being bombarded with financial advice, both solicited and unsolicited. Every other person on social media is a financial guru, and phrases like generational wealth, how to become a millionaire in 2 years, and invest in this cryptocurrency today flood our timelines, along with images of everyone seemingly living their best life, while in many cases leaving us wondering, what am I doing wrong? In today's episode of the Death and Grief Talk podcast, I have the honor of speaking with a credible and reputable source of financial information, Mr. Ricardo Thomas. Ricardo Thomas is a graduate of Loyola University, where he earned a Bachelor's of Business Administration degree in finance. He is a registered financial consultant and a chartered federal employee benefits consultant. Also became a fully licensed investment broker at the age of 19. He is a practicing financial consultant and is the president of Thomas Waddell & Associates, Incorporated, a financial consultant and asset management firm with clients across the country. He has also worked as a divorce financial analyst, served as an expert witness, and consulted on divorce cases where expert opinions were needed on divorce settlements. He is also a former contributing financial writer for both Perspectives Magazine and Women of Excellence Magazine. Mr. Ricardo Thompson, welcome to the Death and Grief Talk podcast. How are you today?
I am fine. How are you?
I am excellent, and I am very excited because very few of us, unless we're very intentional about it, will have the experience of talking one-on-one and getting valuable information from a financial planner for absolutely free. So I am I'm so excited to talk to you and for you being willing to spend this 45 minutes with me and my audience. Everybody on social media is a financial planner now.
So they think.
Telling us how to become millionaires overnight and how to, you know, flex on the gram, basically. But I'm so excited to talk to you because I know you have worked in the financial industry for years, years and years and years. And I just want to give you the opportunity to introduce yourself and tell us about your experience, and we'll go from there.
Well, sure. Well, first of all, thank you for having me. I'm certainly glad to be able to share a little bit of time with you and your audience today to talk about a very important subject that is certainly near and dear to my heart. But I have been a practicing financial consultant. This year makes 39 years. You know, I know it doesn't look like it. It's the Noxzema and the oil of Olay. But, but a graduate of Loyola University here with my degree in finance. I'm licensed as an investment broker, being able to handle the whole nine yards of legitimate investment vehicles. Went on to receive or earn several designations as a registered financial consultant, meaning that I have the education, the licenses, and continuing education each year to maintain that status. I'm also chartered as a federal employee benefit consultant, and I taught for over 10 years at one of the local community colleges, a number of personal finance courses that I developed. My firm, Thomas Waddell & Associates, which is based in the New Orleans area, we've been around since 1987. We currently have clients in 12 states And really, I would say the focal areas of my practice is financial planning, helping us to see where we are and what we have to work with, asset management, which is the execution of that plan and how to get our money working right for us. And that third leg of the stool, which is so, so critical and consistent with what we'll be talking about today, and that's financial education. And that is so, so important because oftentimes we don't know what we don't know. And as a result of that, we end up making some critical financial mistakes that too often we hear said, or we end up saying, if I knew back then what I know now, I would have done differently or I wouldn't have done at all. So that's kind of a little snippet on who I am and what we do.
That's absolutely amazing. And the reason I wanted to talk to you is because so many times in our community, which is the Black and Indigenous community, there's this myth that Black people don't plan, not only for end of life from my part of the spectrum or my end of the spectrum, but we don't know how to manage money. We don't know how to make investments. We don't have financial literacy. And I love what you said about a lot of times we just don't know what we don't know. And one thing that you taught me when we were preparing for this this interview was that part of the reason that we don't have that information is because compared to the grand scheme of things, there's a very, very small percentage of us that have access, education, and experience in the financial world. So would you mind sharing that statistic with me that you shared about the percentage of African-American financial planners that are actually certified in the U.S.?
Sure, absolutely. And that's a very important thing. You know, as you've mentioned before, social media is bombarded with so many quote unquote financial experts and how to get rich quick and this, that, and the other. And you and I both know that since the beginning of time, folks have been looking for the better mousetrap, if you will, the way to get rich quick. And we also both know that that has never worked. And if it has worked, if it has come quickly, then it has gone away quickly as well. As the old adage says in the Bible, a fool and his money soon shall part. But as it relates to the industry, and I'll first go back to when I first started in 1984 and then bring it forward quickly to what the stats are now. When I started out, I was age 18. So my career path and journey is not the typical one at all. You know, with it, because at the time, the stats were in the financial industry, and we're not talking about insurance agents. We're talking about true financial professionals, financial advisors, those who are licensed to handle investments and so forth. The stats were average age 47, which I clearly was nowhere close to that back then, white, which I'm still not, and male, which I am. Now, fortunately, 39 years later, I meet the age criteria and the gender criteria, but still not white. Now, taking it fast forward to the present, when it comes to, and this is why it's so important, and I'm glad that you posed this question, when folks are seeking out a financial professional or wondering about the legitimacy or the credibility of the advice they are getting, there are some certain questions that they should be asking. Number one, does this person do this on a full-time or part-time basis? If they're saying part-time, then 9 times out of 10, they're not a full-fledged financial professional. Case in point, would you deal with a part-time doctor? You know, say, oh, well, on Monday, I'm your doctor. Tuesday, I'm your postman, you know, jack of all trades, master of none. So ask that question. Find out what licenses they have. Are they securities licensed? Are they able to handle stocks and bond transactions or just mutual funds? That makes a difference as to what they can and cannot offer to you. Find out if they are insurance licensed. Find out if they are a captive agent, because if they are, then 9 times out of 10, they're just an insurance agent. And nothing is wrong with that, but they should disclose that up front. So that way you can manage your expectations and make an informed decision as to how you want to go forward or not. Find out if they have the formal educational background. Do they have a degree in finance or economics or something business related? Find out what brokerage firm are they affiliated with. In the United States, by law, if you are securities licensed or if you are to even discuss investments or make recommendations or what have you, you must be affiliated with a registered broker dealer. And all of that information on whatever firm is always available online. But if you ask that question and they say, what is a broker dealer, then it's time to run in the other direction because clearly they're not licensed. So those are some of the questions there. And when you add in all of those ingredients and then of course the different designations, and there's a multitude of designations out there, depending on what that financial professional chooses to specialize in. Just like in the medical field, you know, you have your general practitioner, you know, the internal medicine doctor, but then of course you have your specialist, you know, who can specialize in, you know, cardiology or other areas. Well, some of those same concepts exist in the financial world. So you want to ask those questions. So once you have that information, you can determine whether or not you are dealing with the right person. But when you add all of that into the pot and start filtering through, there's literally these days less than about 4,000 of us that meet that criteria. So when you look at that and you look at the size of our population, you know, in this country, you can see part of the reason why we are not where we should be from a financial standpoint, simply due to a lack of access. And you and I both know that for a long time, access was not afforded to us, and our community as a whole was totally overlooked as it relates to next level financial services. Now, many of us, and certainly going back several generations, many of us are accustomed to that man knocking on the door or knocking on mom's or grandma's door on a Saturday morning for that 50 cents for that $500 burial policy. My family was no different. I remember that, you know, for that $500 burial policy, which you and I both know today isn't enough to buy flowers, you know, and so forth. But that's the reality of where we came from. And truth be told, we had to do the best we could with what was available to us and what we understood. But as the old saying goes, and I'm gonna turn it over back over to you, the old saying goes, when I know better, then I can do better. And that's part of what my job is under that heading of financial education, so that we can know better, make more informed decisions. And in turn, by making better financial decisions, we can better our lives going into retirement and plant the seeds for a better life financially for the next generation and other generations to come.
That is the perfect segue into my next question. I am about to be 37 years old, newlywed, and an entrepreneur. What decisions can myself and younger than me make to ensure that we're not repeating that cycle of we didn't know, so we didn't do? We now know. There's no excuses. We have access to the internet. We have access to individuals like yourself. We have access to YouTube. What decisions do we need to make so that we're not repeating these horror stories of coming into funeral homes and having to have GoFundMe accounts and fish and depending on the community, not only to bury ourselves and our loved ones, but to take care of ourselves once someone has passed away?
So that is a very awesome question, and I'm glad you posed it, because in order to answer that properly, we have to unpack some myths, some age-old myths that many folks hold, regardless of which communities and so forth. And the number one thing is, you know, we figure when we're young, oh, I got time. Retirement is not here now. I'm on the grind now. You know, I'm hustling every day. I'm hustling. I think that's how the song went. All of those things. Or the other one that goes, I've been grinding all my life. You know, and all those things like that. But the reality is, retirement is not a function of age. It's a function of money. And let's unpack that for a minute, because we all grew up in families where we overheard conversations, whether it be our parents, grandparents, aunts, uncles, and say, ooh, child, when I get 65, I'm going to retire. Oh, Lord, I'm so glad I put in my 30 years. I'm going to retire. That was the old thinking of, you know, because we knew Social Security was based upon age 65. And then the old model was you put in your 30 years and then you're going to retire. What was not taken into consideration in that model was that the cost of living continues to go up. Not only that, no two people's lifestyles are the same, or should I say, no two people's price tag for their lifestyle are the same. And so when we think about retirement, we should first calculate and look at what is the price tag for the lifestyle that I want. And I always like to explain it that way because everywhere else in life, when we make decisions, we look at the price tag. You know, if you're going out to look for a new car and you go drive out to the lot and you say, oh, this car is pretty. It has all the bells and whistles and features. Now let me go around to that window on the back of the driver's side, see what the sticker price is. And then you can determine whether or not you could afford that particular model with all those bells and whistles and so forth. And if not, you may have to go to somewhere else on the lot or go to a whole nother lot completely. You know, so same thing when we go into the shopping malls and we're looking at that particular clothing item and say, oh man, that would look great on me until I look at the tag and see that it's $1,000. And say, oh, I better go across the street to Walmart, you know, whatever, like that. So the same thing applies with retirement. And truth be told, the earlier we start, the better chance we have of truly reaching our retirement goals. Because the two ingredients that are absolutely critical in achieving any type of goal that is monetarily based is time and money. The more time you have, meaning the younger you start, the less money it takes to reach your goal. Why? Because you have just that many more years for your money to compound and work for you. The less time we have, then we're trying to make up for lost time, which means we'd have to add more money, or we perhaps have to do some frivolous things with our money to try to make up for that. You know, so it really requires us to start early, to calculate what our retirement price tag is, because one thing that I love about my work, you know, in doing financial planning and particularly with retirement planning, is that it's all based on math. Math is not subjective. Math is objective. No matter who I talk to, 1 + 1 = 2. If they say anything different, if they say, oh, 1 + 1 = 11, well, conversation over. You know, something's wrong there. But 1 + 1 = 2. So when we get on a level playing field and understand how money works, which we'll get into in a second, then we can truly determine what we need to do. And how long it will take to do it. And in that way, you can have realistic expectations. I can't tell you how many times, you know, folks say, oh, well, I got it made. I got enough. Lo and behold, they get to about 60. They look at their 401k or they look at their pension plan and they realize that based upon the amount of money that it takes to run their household and based upon how much they have in their retirement account, they could live that way for about 5 years, then they got to go back out to work and look at all the precious years that they've lost by not taking a comprehensive approach and understanding how money works. So I hope one of your next questions will be, how does money work? Because I think that is truly the foundation of understanding this whole game that we call achieving financial success.
How does money work, Ricardo?
I'm so glad you asked that, Joe. So to that end, we have to understand how money works, meaning how compound interest works. You know, everywhere you turn, you can go up and down the street, you'll see commercials on the internet, you'll see commercials on TV, and saying, oh, we're going to pay you X amount of interest on your money, and it'll say either APR behind it, which stands for annual percentage rate, or APY, which stands for annual percentage yield, and so forth. So we see all of that, you know, certainly from the banks, and we need to understand. So we're going to go through a quick exercise. I'm kind of going to put you on the spot, but I think it's going to be helpful for your audience here. So let's say I gave you a dollar today and said, okay, Joe, pick any bank, credit union, out there. They all work the same way because we talked about math. And let's say you found one that was paying 3% interest. We know a little over a year ago, that was hard to find for a bank to pay 3%. Many of them were paying 1% or less, you know, and so forth. But here's my question. If you found a bank that was paying 3% on your money, and okay, I gave you a dollar, and my question to you is, how long does it take for $1 to grow to just $2 if you're getting 3% of interest on your money? You know how they tell you compound it daily and all of that good stuff. So how long do you think it takes for $1 to grow to $2 if you're getting 3% on your money? And no, you can't look it up on the internet.
Oh my gosh, I don't know. I'd say 9 years, I don't know.
Nine, okay. But and that's why I wanted for us to go through that exercise, because how can we properly evaluate the success or failure of any potential investment, no matter what it is, whether it's a CD, whether it's a savings account, whether it's stocks, bonds, whatever, how can we evaluate how well we're doing if we're not understanding the basics of how compound interest works? Well, for you and your audience today, I'm going to give you a quick and easy way to calculate it. It's called Rule of 72. Okay. This is the one that they conveniently left out of the math books in school. So let's say you're getting 3%. So you just take whatever rate of return, 3, you divide it into the number 72, and it tells you not how many days or weeks, but how many years it takes to double your money one time. So all we're doing is going back. Yep, I'm looking at your expression now. So we're just going back to elementary school, doing some old-fashioned division. 3 goes into 72 how many times? Or 72 divided by 3 equals?
6.
Okay, and you can cheat on this one.
Okay, thank you. Because math is not my forte.
No problem, no problem. Yep, 72 divided by 3. And I'm glad we're going through this because I really want your audience to do this as well. So what's your answer?
24. It would take 24 years to get $2?
Yes. So if you're getting 3% on your money, 3 goes into 72 24 times. So if you had a dollar and getting 3%, it will take 24 years. If you had $1 million and getting 3%, it's going to take 24 years. So the first point is, it's not about how much money you have. Wow. It's about the rate of return. Okay. Now, so think about that for a moment. Remember, I just said up until a little over a year ago, folks weren't even getting 3% on their money. They were getting 1% and less. And some are still getting that. So now let's do the math on that. Let's say you're getting 1%. 1 goes into 72 how many times?
72.
Exactly. So how long will it take for your dollar to grow to $2? 72 years. Neither you or I will be here in 72 years. So when you think, well, we will both be in our hundreds. Now, you might have a better chance than I do. But here's the thing. Now, it's funny you say that, because scientists have said that the person who stands to live to age 144 has now been born.
Really?
Yes. And not only that, insurance companies now, if anyone is going out to buy life insurance, you know, going back about maybe 20 to 30 years ago, most policies would go up to age 95 or to 100. Many policies that are issued today are now going up to age 120. That's because people are living longer. And the fastest growing segment of U.S. society are centenarians, those that are age 100 and above. So just a little fun fact for you there. But getting back to the rule of 72, if it takes me 24 years or 72 years to double my money, unless I'm already starting out with Mega Millions, I'm never going to achieve financial success. I'm never going to create that so-called generational wealth, because I've never even created wealth for myself, much less another generation. So that's the first thing we have to understand, is how money works. When we understand that, then we can start to put all the other pieces in place.
What is generational wealth, Ricardo? Because that's another term we're hearing on social media and Facebook and the internet. Everybody's creating generational wealth for their family. What is generational wealth?
Good question. And it's another one of those hot terms that people like to say, but oftentimes are not doing the things to execute it, to create it. And there's kind of a biblical reference to that. I believe it was in Proverbs that says, a good man leaves an inheritance to his children's children. Okay. Mm-hmm. So a good man or woman leaves an inheritance to his children's children, meaning that when we leave here, that we should not be just leaving bills like you referred to earlier, having to do fish fries and GoFundMes and all of that, you know, to give our loved ones a decent burial. We should be leaving something behind so that the next generation, from a financial standpoint, can kind of pick up the baton and get a little bit further around the relay race. That's what generational wealth is all about. So unfortunately, the term is bandied about everywhere. It's the new buzzword. Everybody's talking about it. But to be honest about it, I can't create generational wealth if I haven't first created wealth for myself. You know what I'm saying? I can't take care of a generation that's not even here yet if I can't even pay my bills. So I think a lot of people have jumped on that bandwagon because it makes it sound good. But until we do the things of the foundation, which is first understanding how money works, two, understanding what it takes to have a successful retirement, until we do those things, generational wealth, or the term, is nothing more than a pipe dream. Because if we're not buying life insurance to give our family members a decent burial or to leave our loved ones in a decent financial position so that when we die, that the family standard of living can be maintained. If I'm not doing those kind of basic things of having homeowners insurance and auto insurance and doing IRAs and so forth, then I can totally forget about generational wealth. That's just a term that sounds good to the ear.
Wow. So how do we position ourselves to create not only wealth, but to not live in a way that eliminates the true possibility for retirement?
Very good question. So the first step starts literally with what we're doing right here. And it's getting ourselves financially literate, getting the proper education as it relates to personal finance. Because let's face it, for all of us, who are our first teachers about money? Our parents. For better or worse, okay? Because they did the best they could with what they knew, and who did they learn it from? Their parents, for better or worse, because they did the best they could with what they knew or what was available to them. Remember, there's that word access again. So we have to take it upon ourselves to get educated and make sure we are seeking information that is proper and not just getting information that's confirming what we think it is. You know, well, I want to go out there and listen to somebody that's just going to tell me what I want to hear. No, I need to know the truth. So we have to educate ourselves because, again, I'll go biblical again. It says a wise man seeks unto what? Wise counsel. I'll share with you a quick story. One of my mentors early in the industry, he shared with me, we were sitting in his office one time, and he said, here's the key to achieving financial success. He said, go to the richest person you know, ask them for their financial advice, and do what they say. Mm. So he said, now, if you don't know anyone who's rich, you know, who's financially successful, find the poorest slob you know that has nothing. Ask them for their financial advice, and whatever they tell you to do, do just the opposite. Because again, we have to make sure that we're getting the proper information. You know, if I've never achieved any level of financial success or what have you, how can I give someone else advice on it? And I'm not speaking as a professional now, I mean, just as an individual. You know, if you're coming to me and you're seeing me on the corner with a sign saying we'll work for food or whatever, I can't necessarily be a financial guru. You know what I'm saying? To your point earlier, that everybody and their grandma on the internet now claims to be a financial expert. So we have to first make sure that we are getting our information or our advice from qualified professionals that's going to tell us the truth, whether we like it or not. And I'll just say this quickly. When I go to a doctor, I don't want a doctor who's going to be my best cheerleader and tell me, oh, Ricardo, everything's great. And then when I walk out the door, I say, poor bum doesn't realize he has 60 days to live. No, I need him to tell me the truth so we can address the real situation and put me on whatever medications or regimen that is required to get me better. Same thing with our finances. So we got to educate ourselves. We have to be realistic about our expectations based upon the resources that we have available. So, you know, if I only can invest $100 a month, then I can't realistically expect to be on the Forbes 100 list next year. That's not real. You know what I'm saying? So a lot of it has to do with education and realistic expectations.
So I'm going to call this episode To Have and To Hold. And you've basically given us a few steps to having access and creating wealth. How do we hold on to it? Because I can speak from personal experience that I am in awe of what my grandparents created financially. And for them to have been young professionals in the 50s, 60s, and then for me to be living in a home that they built 50 years ago, they had to have a strategy for holding on to what they created, which I think is essential for all of us. There's no point in exchanging our biggest commodity, which is our time, for jobs, to work and strategize well enough to retire, and then to see it all disappear because we didn't make good decisions to plan to hold on to it, or for future generations to hold on to it, Ricardo. So how do we hold on to, even if it's not millions of dollars and grand estates and all the things that we see on TV, how do we guarantee that what we've created doesn't die with us?
And I'm so glad you're bringing that up. That's a very good point. And I'll start first with what you said at the end, with what we see on TV. Unfortunately, most of what we see on TV is not real. It's fake. You know, for all these reality shows, housewives of this, husbands of that, you know, it's ironic that the housewife shows, most of them ain't even married.
Right. You know what I'm saying? Yes.
You start to do a little digging, most of them are not even wealthy. You know what I'm saying? So it's a facade. So that's the first thing. I'll have to go back to the old Public Enemy song where it says, don't believe the hype. That's the first thing. But going back to the beginning of what you said about previous generations, it was a difference in priorities. So when we go back one, two, three generations, they realized that from the situations they were coming from, they knew they were not going to be able to accomplish everything they wanted for themselves. So they made a conscious decision of, and we've all heard it, said, well, okay, I want to make sure that my kids or my grandkids have it better than me. So here comes that dirty word to us now. So they made sacrifices in order to have the things that they have. They didn't worry about having all the name brand clothes now because they wanted to make a sacrifice so that they can buy a home that they can pass on to their children or that they can pass on to their grandchildren. And so that's why I said there's been a shift in priorities because not everybody is willing to sacrifice, you know? And then there's that next word, budget. Uh-oh, what do you mean I have to budget?
You set up a storm. I don't think you can talk like that on this show, Ricardo.
See? And here's the thing that's so funny with that. Even the richest people on the planet live on a budget. Now, their budget might be bigger than yours or mine, but they still live on a budget. And too often, we see many of our biggest entertainers and athletes make more money in a year than most of us will make in multiple lifetimes and end up flat broke. So that tells us several things. That number one, they haven't sought wise counsel. Mm-hmm. And number two, that having more money does not necessarily equal financial success or generational wealth, because they had the money, but they didn't know what to do with it. And as we're talking right now, Fantasia, and it's online, just did a story about her poor financial situation she's in and having to regroup again, and how she even said in the article, she said, don't believe what you're seeing at the shows, all this glitz and glamour that you see all the artists out here with, and they're going home poor. I mean, think about it. When we go back and look at the New Edition documentary, and they talked about their journey in the beginning, how they went on tour all over the United States. And then when they got back home, they threw them off the tour bus and they went back to living the projects, and each of them got a check for about $100. And you say, well, wait a minute. They had all these big hits and all of these things like that. Don't believe the hype. We have to make sure we take care of business. We have to sacrifice and realize that all of it was not built in one day. And we have to be disciplined to learn to live within our means, because that's one of those key ingredients when we talk about generational wealth. If I'm always in the red, then there's nothing left to create generational wealth. I have to spend less than what I make to get ahead. You know, so a lot of these things here are just basic fundamentals, because isn't it funny that when we go back a couple of generations, that our parents and grandparents, as it relates to the income they made, is nothing compared to what we make, but yet they had so much. And I'll share one of my own family examples. I'll never forget, and I love sharing this, that my grandfather in New Orleans here back in 1955 built a 3-bedroom brick home, and his monthly mortgage was $55. And that was a struggle. You and I pay more than that a month for our cell phone bill. You know what I'm saying? So that helps to put it in perspective. You know, we'll spend $50, $100 on dinner and think nothing of it. Or go see Beyonce and spend $200-$300 per ticket and think nothing of it. So we have to be realistic about our expectations. We have to spend less than we make, and we have to be willing to sacrifice. If we're not willing to do that, then we can't expect a different end result. And I'll end this answer with this. What's the definition of insanity? Keep doing the same thing and expecting a different result. So there you go.
Thank you so much for that. And I mean, like you were saying, when you go to the doctor, you don't want the doctor to tell you everything's okay when it's not. And I almost think I'm seeing two things. On one end, I'm seeing more and more people since the pandemic honestly come in with life insurance, honestly come in with, even if it's not the full amount for the funeral bill, something, because seeing so many people die back to back to back out of nowhere for a lot of people, I think woke something up with us, especially in our community. Right. Another thing that kind of goes along with that is that I'm seeing, especially here in South Carolina, we don't necessarily have the traditional life insurance policies, but we come into the funeral home ready to barter with land or other commodities.
Oh, wow.
Okay. But on the other hand, I'm seeing younger and younger people come into the funeral home because they're killing themselves, committing suicide, because they are stuck in the illusion that they're somehow behind in life because of what's being perpetuated on those television shows and in movies, and particularly on social media, where, like we said in the beginning, everyone is a financial guru. And I'm not in any way blaming these individuals that are giving that message. However, I do think conversations about finances are important. And a lot of times prior to the pandemic, I would see where people would come in and this was the first conversation they were having. And when I say come in, come into the funeral home, And that would be the first time as a family that they were discussing money. And to me, that would be heartbreaking because I can remember being a little girl and both my grandparents on both sides, my grandma on my dad's side and my grandparents on my mom's side, my parents, godparents, I remember having this little, it was like a game, but it was a checking system. Whenever I would get my allowance, I'd have to do the debits or do the credits to my allowance account. And I just could not fathom when this first started happening. How is this as a family that this is the first time you're discussing money? But in the same breath, as I shared with you before, a lot of our seniors feel as if asking them about money and their finances is very intrusive. So I guess in closing, how do we introduce this conversation about finances, financial planning, financial literacy into our families today? Without being intrusive and creating realistic expectations for the next generation?
Well, first, wow, you've packed a lot into that. So I'll do my best to try to answer all of that because all of those are critical points that have to be addressed if we want to have a different end result. So I'll start first with our seniors because that's the foundation and work our way up. And you're absolutely right. You know, oftentimes in our community, my family was no different and folks around me, you know, we were always concerned about, I don't want people in my business. I don't want people to know my business and so forth. And I tell people till this day, well, you're so concerned about me knowing your business and so forth. Well, when the sheriff is in front of your house, putting your stuff on the sidewalk, I know your business anyway. Or when I'm looking in the newspaper and I'm seeing your house is up for sale because you haven't paid the taxes, I know your business anyway. Or now, because we're sophisticated, we're on GoFundMe and you're asking people to make donations for your burial. Well, it doesn't take a rocket scientist to figure out that you haven't taken care of your business. The second part of it is like you mentioned, that there's now this heightened awareness since the pandemic to, you know, get life insurance and so forth. Now, that's good only to an extent because, again, look what it took, the loss of life, the loss of a loved one to wake us up. And what we have to realize is that at that particular time, I might be woke now about the importance of life insurance, but my health may be that I can't qualify for life insurance anymore, or I'm much older now, so I may not be able to afford the amount that I really should have for my family. So procrastinating definitely costs us. And we've seen that in the case of the pandemic, I mean, where we saw people of various different ages die from it, you know, from COVID, thinking, oh, well, I got time, I'll get to it. And now it left the family grossly unprepared. The youngest person I know of here that died from COVID was 19 years old, you know? Yeah, so that's the thing. But as it relates to how do we get people to really start talking about it, and I'll go back to the pandemic and look at the devastation that it caused, obviously emotionally, you know, losing a loved one. But the secondary impact is the financial impact. And so the question is, if I do not want to repeat that experience again in my family or, you know, for myself or other loved ones, what do I need to do differently now so that situation does not repeat itself? And it starts with a conversation, you know, amongst key family members. And again, we all know in our families who we can trust and who we cannot trust, who we should share stuff with and who we should say, I don't know about that. So we all know, you know, that. And then from there, seek out qualified financial professionals to sit down and give us guidance. Because I can't tell you how many times folks have come in here, you know, to me and say, oh, I got this done and I got that. That's okay. Well, let's get a second opinion on it. Bring in those documents and let's take a look. And what they thought they had and what they really had was two totally different things. You know, and I said, well, okay, with what you have, this is the consequences of what you have. And is that what you wanted? Oh, absolutely not. Well, that's what your document is saying. Or because you don't have this in place, this is what's going to happen to your assets upon death or upon the situation where you are not in a mental capacity to make decisions anymore. So I think the key way to really try to encourage us to start having these vital conversations is to look at the consequences of what happens when we don't have these things in place. And certainly, hopefully, that should motivate folks to say, well, I don't want to deal with that, or I've seen that happen to someone else. I don't want to experience that. What do I need to do, or who do I need to sit down with so that I can get a different result?
Thank you so much, Ricardo. Unfortunately, we are out of time, so I'm just going to go ahead, and because I know there's going to be lots of comments and questions once viewers hear this or see this episode. So I want to go ahead and invite you back for a part two.
Okay.
But until then, could you please let everyone know exactly where they could find you and how to get in contact with you?
Absolutely. Well, first of all, thank you again for this opportunity. I've truly enjoyed having this dialogue with you. And it's through opportunities like this, where hopefully it stirs that energy up in people to start having those conversations or to start planning with themselves, you know, about these key areas and so forth. But certainly folks can reach out on my website at www.thomaswaddell.net. They can also follow me on Twitter at TWA Connect. That's TWA, like the old airline back in the day, TWA Connect. Or they can also follow me on Facebook at Thomas Waddell Associates. So any of those they can reach us at, and they're welcome to request to get on our newsletter list. We do a free monthly newsletter on a variety of timely financial topics. They can request that. Hopefully soon we'll have some webinars that we're doing on a variety of financial topics. Obviously now, since you've requested, I'll be back here with you. But utilizing any of those platforms, whether it's our website, whether it's us on Twitter or our Facebook page, feel free to have them to reach out, and we'll do what we can to either help them or at least point them in the right direction.
Thank you so much, Ricardo. And thank you to each and every one of you for watching and listening to this episode of the Death and Grief Talk podcast. Live life, love hard, and we'll talk to you next time. Thank you so much for listening to this episode of the Death and Grief Talk podcast. To learn more about the Grave Woman, visit www.thegravewoman.com. Also follow us on social media at The Grave Woman.